local headlines, more than 30 Palestinians are injured as Israeli settlers once again attack the occupied West Bank town of Hawara. Israeli warplanes carry out a new strike on Syria, this time targeting the international airport in the city of Aleppo and putting it out of service. And Beijing warns that Taiwan is the first red line that Washington must not cross, urging the U.S. to change its path or risk conflict. Thanks for joining us. The occupied West Bank town of Hawara is witnessing more settler violence days after a deadly Israeli raid against Palestinian residents of the area. The new incursion into the town has left 31 Palestinians injured. They were attacked by settlers backed by the Israeli military. Last week, hundreds of settlers attacked the town south of Nablus, opened fire on Palestinian homes, and set fire to buildings and cars. They killed one Palestinian and injured at least 390 others. The violence was welcomed by an Israeli cabinet minister, who said that Hawara must be wiped out. The UN High Commissioner for Human Rights has slammed his comments as an unfathomable incitement of violence. The Arab League and the European Union have also condemned the violence in Hawara. Israel has launched a fresh air raid against Syria this time, targeting the international airport in the northwestern city of Aleppo. The Syrian Defense Ministry says the airstrike caused significant damage, putting the airport's runway out of service. The ministry says that forced the closure of the airport, making it impossible to receive aid for Syrians hit by the last month's earthquake. It said aid deliveries have now been diverted to Damascus and Latakia airports. Meanwhile, Syrian media say the country's air defenses shut down a number of the Israeli missiles. The regime frequently carries out missile attacks on targets in Syria. Damascus has repeatedly complained to the UN, urging the Security Council to take action against Tel Aviv's crimes. The Secretary General of Lebanon's Hezbollah resistance movement says all recent developments indicate the last days of the Zionist regime. Regarding the cause of Palestine, Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah urged the new generations to learn about the resistance prisoners' sacrifices. Our Beirut correspondent Mariam Saleh has more.
He made these statements on the day of the wounded, but this was also the day of the prisoner. And this is why he was able to go towards the issue of the Palestinian prisoners, which he considered a very significant cause, especially in light of the possible law that could be taken by the Israeli cabinet, which he called a foolish cabinet, which is pushing this entity, and he called it, of course, a temporary entity, pushing it towards its own destruction and its own demise. So basically going from that spiritual event to what is happening right now and how significant the events of Palestine are and how the entire region and the people of the region need to support Palestine. And from that, of course, he went to the significance of the resistance in Lebanon and how they suffered all the years of occupation until the day when we saw this resistance being fruitful. We saw the liberation of 2000. We saw in 2006 how the Israeli soldiers, there were some 80,000 soldiers ready to invade Lebanon. They could not take one step into Lebanese territory, and he compared it to what used to happen in 1978, for example, how only 20,000 Israeli soldiers and officers were able to invade Lebanon. So he pushed that as an example for Palestine, that this will only continue and this will add to the resistance, that all of the decisions being made by this, as he called it, the foolish, extremist, Zionist cabinet in the entity, in this regime, that it will only be pushing the youngsters towards resistance even more, when these youngsters also do not fear death.
Iran's top general says the country has started the mass production of ballistic missiles, capable of destroying moving maritime targets. Chief of Staff of the Iranian Armed Forces says Iran is now among the three countries possessing the know-how to make such missiles. Major General Mohammad Baghari said the missiles are capable of pinpoint and high-speed strikes against targets up to 1,500 kilometers away. Iran has in recent years made great strides in manufacturing a broad range of military hardware, helping its defense industry achieve self-sufficiency in this sector. Iran says its military prowess is intended to deter threats and to defend against any aggression. Iranians have planted saplings to mark the National Tree Planting Day. The event is celebrated every year on the 15th day of Isfand, the last month of the Iranian calendar. The country has launched a campaign to plant 1 billion trees in 4 years. Saman Khujuri reports.
Iranians have observed the National Tree Planting Day as part of the Natural Resources Week by planting saplings across the country. The country has now launched a wider campaign to plant 1 billion trees in 4 years. Accordingly, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, marked the National Tree Planting Day by planting 3 saplings. Meanwhile, President Ebrahim Raisi went to the National Botanical Garden of Iran in Tehran to mark the event and start a campaign to plant 1 billion trees nationwide. The Natural Resources Week represents more than just planting trees. It's a strong message of protecting the environment and changing attitudes and lifestyles. Each tree means a gift from the current generation to posterity to have a green and healthy planet. National Tree Planting Day is annually celebrated on the 15th day of Isfand, the last month on the Iranian calendar. The day also marks the beginning of the National Week of Natural Resources.
Iranians have always paid special attention to nature. They believe planting saplings will make the world a better place to live for us, our children, and the generations to come. Saman Khujuri, Tehran.
President Xi Jinping has denounced the U.S. for leading a campaign to suppress China and to impede the country's development.
Western countries led by the United States have implemented all-round containment, encirclement, and suppression of China, which has brought unprecedented severe challenges to our country's development.
Xi was addressing a meeting of the National People's Congress. He called for self-reliance in the face of U.S. pressure and sanctions aimed at stopping China's economic progress. Xi's comments on the U.S. efforts to contain China resembles that of the country's top diplomat. Foreign Minister Qin Gang has warned Washington against suppressing Beijing, saying that it would provoke conflict.
The United States claims to be competing to win against China rather than seeking a conflict. But in fact, the U.S. so-called competition is total containment and suppression, a zero-sum game in which you die and I live. If the U.S. does not hit the brakes but continues to speed down the wrong path, no amount of guardrails can prevent derailing. There will surely be conflict and confrontation.
The Chinese foreign minister also said the issue of Taiwan is the first red line that the U.S. must respect, as the two economic powers are on a collision course over the self-ruled island.
Bedrock of the political foundation of China-U.S. relations and the first red line that must not be crossed in China-U.S. relations. The United States has an unshakable responsibility for causing the Taiwan question. The reason we are talking to the U.S. about the Taiwan issue is to ask Washington not to interfere in China's internal affairs.
China has repeatedly rebuked the U.S. for its growing nexus with Taiwan as it regards the self-ruled island as a sovereign territory. Apart from Taiwan, the East China Sea, as well as the Ukraine war, are other sources of frictions between Beijing and Washington. Bilateral relations took a turn for the worse after the U.S. shot down what it called a Chinese spy balloon over its airspace last month. Beijing is critical of Washington's handling of the issue. Pyongyang has criticized the upcoming war games between the U.S. and South Korea in the region. The North Korean leader's powerful sister says that the country will see it as a declaration of war if Washington takes a military action against Pyongyang's strategic weapon test. The allies are planning to conduct more than 10 days of large-scale military drills starting next week. North Korea views regular U.S.-led military exercises in the region, particularly those with South Korea, as an invasion rehearsal. Pyongyang has accused the U.S. of aggravating the tensions in the Korean Peninsula through its recent joint air drills with Seoul. In recent months, North Korea has fired a large number of missiles, including ICBMs, in what it calls a warning to its enemies. Our Seoul correspondent Frank Smith earlier told us that there are signs of growing tensions on the Korean Peninsula.
Well, from March 13th to March 23rd, it's conducting a couple of drills called Freedom Shield is one, and another one is Warrior Shield. Warrior Shield will be field exercises, and Freedom Shield is computer war simulations. The South Korean government has said it wants more realistic training with U.S. forces here in South Korea. President Yoon Suk-yeol is taking a much more hawkish line toward North Korea and has said that he's going to respond to any provocations from North Korea, labeling those missile tests that you mentioned as provocations, that South Korea is going to respond to those more forcefully. And there was a report recently of a U.S. general suggesting that future missile launches of North Korea may be intercepted, something that Kim Yo-jong, that's the sister of North Korean leader Kim Jong-un, said would be a declaration of war. So certainly we're seeing some tension increase here on the Korean Peninsula.
Ukraine says it will not retreat from the eastern city of Bakhmut and is determined to defend the city, which has been surrounded by Russian forces. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky says that he has ordered military commanders to reinforce troops after they supported continuing the defense of the city. On the battlefield, however, Russian forces are reportedly making advances in and around the city. Both sides are also calling for more weapons, as months of fighting have reduced their ammunition reserves. In recent weeks, the Russian army has tightened the siege around the city in a bid to force Ukrainian troops to surrender. Capture of Bakhmut in the Donetsk region would pave the way for the Russians to seize the last remaining urban areas in the region. Italy seems once again to be opening up to producing nuclear energy, as some Italian firms have signed an agreement with the French energy group. Can Italy really return to nuclear power? Max Civoli reports from Rome.
Italy is seriously mulling over resorting to developing its nuclear energy in this crucial geopolitical conjuncture. On Monday, three Italian energy firms, Ansaldo Energia, Ansaldo Nucleare and Edison Spa, announced that they have signed a letter of intent with major French utility Électricité de France, also known as EDF. The deal features collaboration on the development of new nuclear projects in Europe and, quote, to open a debate on the possible role of new nuclear power in Italy's energy transition.
Italy's Edison Energy Company says it wants to produce its own nuclear energy starting from between 2030 and 2035. This would be obtained thanks to provisions which have introduced considerable simplifications of the procedures to build smaller and safer nuclear plants. However, the risk is that the projects may encounter strong opposition by local governments.
Italy closed its nuclear plants in 1990 after a referendum on atomic energy held 3 years earlier, following a new referendum held in 2011 when 94% of Italians voted again against the atomic option. The idea of a return to nuclear power seemed dead and buried. However, the energy crisis triggered by the war in Ukraine seems to have changed people's mind in Italy. According to latest surveys, while only 15% of Italians are fully supportive of nuclear energy, one in two Italians believe that switching back to nuclear energy could be a solution to the issue of high energy bills if safer and cleaner nuclear technology is employed.
I am in favor of the nuclear option because we already buy nuclear-produced energy from France and Spain. And if there is an accident at the plants over there, we would also suffer from the consequences.
Nuclear energy is produced by several European countries these days. Why not in Italy? Maybe this decision should be adopted at a European level.
The issue of nuclear energy came up again in Italy in 2021, particularly following the former Mario Draghi's government expressing support for the return to nuclear power in the country. This was then followed by a consensual agreement voiced by the current Prime Minister, Giorgia Meloni. Max Civili, Rome.
In France, refineries have stopped fuel deliveries as workers have begun massive strikes against the government's pension reform plan. The CGT labor union says the workers have started the strikes everywhere, blocking deliveries from all refineries. Petroleum firm Total Energies has also reported the impact of the strikes on domestic markets, saying 64% of its workers have joined the industrial action. All major unions have called on workers to walk out of their jobs over the pension reform plan. The government wants to increase the retirement age from 62 to 64, arguing that the change is necessary. However, the opponents say that the plan would penalize low-skilled workers who who start their careers early while reducing their right to leisure and a long retirement at the end. French President Emmanuel Macron has wrapped up his tour of Africa, where he met with officials of several countries, including Gabon and the Democratic Republic of Congo. Macron used the visits to push for a new era in economic and military terms in what is widely seen as an attempt to mend France's image as a colonizer in the continent.
French President Emmanuel Macron has concluded his Africa tour, which took him to several countries, including Republic of Gabon, Angola, and the Democratic Republic of Congo. The ultimate goal? To restore the already tarnished image of France on the continent. In Gabon, this was obvious since day one. Some soldiers welcomed the arrival of the French president at the exit of the Libreville airport. But red, white, blue flags and the crowds on the road were absent all the way to the presidential palace. There, Macron participated with several African heads of state in a summit devoted to protecting tropical forests. In the Democratic Republic of Congo, Macron held talks with the country's president in capital Kinshasa, which last week saw several demonstrations in a sign of rising anti-French sentiment in parts of Africa. At a joint press conference, Macron acknowledged France was among foreign powers pushing for influence in Africa. He, however, said that he was committed to working with the African nations on an equal footing. Macron underlined that his country wants to be long-term partners to African countries, adding that the continent is a theater of competition. Macron's tour to Africa was his 18th visit to the continent. His trip follows a recent slew of African tours by high-level U.S., Russian, and Chinese officials seeking closer ties. France has endured a recent messy breakdown in relations with some former colonies in West Africa, and Macron's first-time visit to Gabon, Angola, and the Republic of Congo indicates his wish to turn the page. The French president last week outlined France's new Africa policy, saying military bases would be co-run with host nations and commercial and other interests pursued with respect and humility.
And with that, we come to an end for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. As a reminder, we discussed the election of Abul Hassan Bani Sadr as the first Iranian president and also talked about the events leading to his dismissal. This time, we are going to touch upon the period between Bani Sadr's escape from the country and the election of martyr Muhammad Ali Rajai as the second president of the Islamic Republic of Iran. Stay tuned, please. The period of mid-June till mid-August 1981 was the time when Abul Hassan Bani Sadr was deposed of presidency and Muhammad Ali Rajai was elected as the second president of the Islamic Republic of Iran. Bani Sadr was dismissed due to his mismanagement as the president, particularly in the field of administration of the war as the commander-in-chief of the armed forces. Many important events occurred during this period. The martyrdom of Dr. Mustafa Chamran was one of these events. He was one of the brave commanders of the war and had devoted his life to the cause of Imam Khomeini and the Islamic Revolution since he was in the U.S. as a student or a guerrilla combatant in Lebanon. The news of his martyrdom was very sad for the Iranian people. Imam Khomeini's wife was dumbfounded at hearing the news. Ms. Khadija Saghafi had said on Chamran, "Chamran was a mythical man. What we hear about him may be unbelievable for the next generations." A few days after Chamran's martyrdom, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei was injured in a terrorist act while speaking at Abu Zar Mosque in the south of Tehran. He was Imam Khomeini's representative at the Supreme Defense Council, a member of the Islamic Assembly Council or Parliament, and the leader of Friday Congregational Prayer in Tehran. He was the person who had mentioned some of the points of political incompetency of Bani Sadr at the Parliament. Just one day after this act of terror, some 72 officials were martyred in a bomb blast at the place of the Islamic Republic Party. The judiciary chief of the time, Ayatollah Muhammad Hosseini Beheshti, was the highest official who lost his life during the explosion. The blast was carried out by the MKO terrorist grouplet, which killed more than 17,000 people, mostly innocent men, women, and children. The imposed war, successive martyrdom of the companions of Imam Khomeini, economic shortages and criminal acts of terrorist outfits such as the MKO could not impact Imam Khomeini's iron willpower and firm belief in God. On the contrary, he kept calling on people to put their trust in God and resist against the enemies of Islam and Iran. In such circumstances, some people were seeking to attribute mythical acts and extraordinary measures to the Imam, but the Imam's wife blocked the way of such superstitions and the likely consequences. During a meeting with some of the ladies from various walks of life, one of the attendees asked for some miracles from Imam Khomeini. The Imam's wife answered, "One of the miracles of the Imam is that I have never heard a lie from him during living with him. Another miracle of him is that he never dissipates a single riyal, Iranian currency. His third miracle is that he seriously avoids extravagance. The last miracle is that, unlike many mystics who shun people, the Imam believes in people. He expects miracle from people and believes that people can work a miracle." Then she read out part of the Imam's words, where he had said, "It is a miracle that you, sisters and brothers together, with one sound and clenched fist, have stood against satanic powers. This is the miracle of Islam, which has been manifested in you. This is a miracle that the martyrdom of a dear one stirs up a wave in the world. This is a miracle that ladies do not fear against tanks, cannons, and machine guns." Dear listeners, it is very interesting to know how martyr Ayatollah Beheshti was careful of every minute point within the domain of his responsibility. For instance, while Bani Sadr had gone into hiding after dismissal, his wife was arrested on the street. She was provoking people through chanting slogans in favor of her husband. Ayatollah Beheshti, being informed of the event, phoned the prosecutor general and told him with discontent, "Although we have differences with Bani Sadr, his allegations have not been proved in any just court yet, and even if they are proved, no one is allowed to insult or violate the rights of his wife. Thus, Bani Sadr's wife should be freed in less than 24 hours. If this does not happen, I will do the job personally as the judiciary chief." Dear listeners, Martyr Beheshti said these words while Bani Sadr had left no stone unturned in calumniating him and insulting him here and there. Imam Khomeini, as soon as hearing what Martyr Beheshti's statements read, said, "Mr. Beheshti is right. If that lady has been arrested for this purpose and she has no other allegation, she should be freed right now. Moreover, they should offer an apology to her too." Ahmad Agha was happy with the political piety of Ayatollah Beheshti, and he described it to her mother. Lady Saghafi told him on Martyr Beheshti, "This man should be appreciated. Thank him on my behalf." The Imam's wife went to Bani Sadr's wife several times and, in spite of being upset with Bani Sadr, never spoke behind her in any party.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
And welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashmi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, Iran has once again agreed to commit itself to cooperating with the International Atomic Energy Agency, IAEA Chief Rafael Grossi, after visiting Iran and returning to Vienna, said that both sides understand the importance of positive engagements in paving the way for wider agreements. However, the director of the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran, Mohammad Islami, has said that Tehran won't give in to Washington's maximum pressure campaign and attempts to pressure the country through the UN nuclear watchdog. Well, what does all of this mean? Stay with me on the spotlight so we can look at the significance of all of this. I'd like to welcome my guests to the program. Elijah McNair, journalist and political analyst out of Brussels. And Scott Ritter, former UN weapons inspector out of Bethlehem, New York. Well, thank you both for being with me. And start this off in Brussels. And Elijah, your thoughts. How significant do you think Grossi's recent visit to Iran and the comments that both sides have made afterwards? How significant is it overall?
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for coming.
I think it's extremely significant because it de-escalates the tension between Europe, the United States, and Iran and the agency. Because Iran took several steps just to send a clear message to the U.S. that the nuclear deal should be on the table, should be respected, and there is a need for all parties to return to it. And any step that is taken by the U.S., imposing more sanctions on Iran or keeping the harsh sanctions, it means Iran will have to escalate, keeping in mind that since 2015, when the JCPOA was agreed, the U.S. did not respect fully the agreement. And in 2018, the Americans left the agreement. And for Iran to start coming out of the agreement, it took a full year until 2019. And only when Biden took the power, then Iran started to increase the enrichment uranium. For the main request of Iran for the IAEA to remain professional and to keep its professionalism, not to be involved in politics. And I think Iran was referring to the November announcement of Rafael Grossi when he said he was concerned about Iranian hypersonic missiles. This is not the job of the IAEA to monitor Iranian missiles, but to monitor the enrichment uranium and to make sure that Iran is abiding by agreement. So when Grossi said he's neither pessimistic or optimistic, this is a vague, huge step. It means that all the call of the European countries involved in the JCPOA that were calling to escalate against Iran is frozen at the moment until the final decision is reached following Grossi's report.
Okay, well, what about you, Scott? How do you see this latest move or this action that is taking place right now between Iran and the IAEA? You heard what Elijah said, that he felt that it was very significant. Do you agree that it is significant, and do you agree that it can help calm tensions or not?
No, I believe this is significant. It's what I would call escalation management by the Iranians. They've, of course, taken a very hard-line, principled stand on the allowing the United States back into the JCPOA. There were the termination of those talks, or at least the cessation of those talks, has caused problems and created uncertainty in Vienna, especially amongst the European participants in this agreement. And there are several unresolved issues that are well known. Grossi and the Iranian side have talked about this. And if these unresolved issues were left to percolate on their own, it would just complicate what I believe is Iran wants, which is the United States to indeed return under the conditions set forth by Iran. There are some complicated back-channel discussions apparently taking place between Iran and the United States. And the last thing either the Americans or the Iranians need is for the IAEA to be escalating tension by further sanctioning, further calling out of Iran. So these talks, as the gentleman from Brussels indicated, they put a freeze on that pressure. They put it on hold.
Well, Scott, let me just jump in with what you just said. You talked about that the last thing that would be needed, according to you, that there's some talks being that are taking place. But you said that the last thing needed would be the IAEA to sanction, for example, Iran, and hindering the possibilities of things moving forward. Do you think that the IAEA really works independently of the United States to make such a decision on its own?
The IAEA works on momentum, and right now the momentum is generated by unresolved issues. And so these take on a life of their own. And as I said, left unresolved, this momentum will go forward and cause an increase in tensions. And I also believe that the United States is engaged in back-channel talks. It's been denied, but there's apparent reason to believe that this is indeed the case. So the United States would be sending signals, discrete signals, to the IAEA and to Vienna to allow the Grossi talks to go forward and to create the opportunity to freeze on this. Nothing happens in isolation, but I think it's in the United States' interest to have this issue stabilized and not spin out of control.
Of course, Elijah, from the Iranian government side, we know that so far they said without the United States changing its MO, it is not interested in actually talking with the United States and dealing with the JCPOA in that frame with them. But in general, do you think that the IAEA can be an honest broker when dealing with Iran, Elijah?
What is important is to see both sides. From the Iranian side, Iran needs some trustful indication from the IAEA. When we hear Grossi talking about the Iranian missiles, this is not his job. He's sending very strong message to Iran to say, well, I'm not that neutral and I am not really not taking a side. And because there is a deal and is signed by both parties, there is no need for trust. And when we see the deal is broken by one side, it means the trust is completely absent. So it is the right of Iran to feel and to understand that the IAEA, that is an international organization under the control of the United Nations, means it is also under the control of the United States and other Western allies, because they were the driving force to push the IAEA to go to Iran, to put pressure on Iran and say, well, we have an independent job. The problem is it is not in the capability of the IAEA to establish this trust with Iran, because there is no trust with the U.S. and because the U.S. left the JCPOA and European did not respect their end of the bargain. So trust is absent. Therefore, it is in the right of Iran to think that Rafael Grossi, at the end of the day, is not someone who is completely neutral and professional, and Iran to walk very cautiously with Grossi, particularly when he said, we want the return of the camera to operate and have access. And the Iranian said, well, all the chips and all the films are there, but we abide by the decision of our council, and you will have it at the end of the negotiation when everything returned to normality. So Iran is saying, why should I abide by the West's request when the West is not doing anything and is not holding the end of the deal on its side?
What about that, Scott? I mean, from the Iranian perspective, they've seen a lot of different things. For example, questioning even the independence of the IAEA, have seen information, critical information that it has been shared, apparently, for example, with Israel. So with that scenario, in your perspective, I mean, how can this move forward? What can happen? What needs to happen?
What needs to happen is what's happening. I don't think anybody should be under any illusions that Iran views the IAEA as a truly independent actor. They know the history of the IAEA. They know the role played by the IAEA. They know the pressure that the IAEA has put under from the United States and others. They also understand diplomacy. They understand the need for back channels and front channels, and sometimes those channels operate at the same time. And right now, Iran, I believe, has a back channel of communications with the United States that needs to remain out of no sunlight because of the delicate nature, the politically sensitive nature of the topics. And so we have the front channel, Grossi. Grossi would not have gone to Iran without the permission of the United States. Grossi's itinerary was approved by the United States, and Grossi is reporting back to the United States. But this is a channel designed to create stability. It's not meant to be something separate from the other negotiations. They're part and parcel of the same thing, but diplomacy sometimes requires multiple tracks.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Elijah, Iran may allow the cameras to roll again inside various facilities. Of course, this is after talks go forward and possible agreements are made. I mean, your overall thoughts about that possibility. Do you see Iran going beyond its responsibilities, or no, is it just doing the bare minimum? How do you assess all of this?
We have two sides, the side of the Iranian saying, I want to return to JCPOA and I will abide by all its articles. And we have the other side saying, I can't offer any guarantee that further sanctions are not going to be imposed on you again. This is what Iran is asking for, the guarantee that Biden not only failed to provide, but has increased from 3,600 sanctions imposed on Iran, and he added several hundred additional sanctions. This is not someone with a good faith and who want to return to JCPOA. Therefore, there is no need and there is no reason for the U.S. to return to JCPOA as long as Iran is saying, I am not making the nuclear bomb. So why would any U.S. president who is looking after and protecting his dominance of the world release dozens of billions of dollars frozen in the Western banks, society, companies, and countries that belong to Iran for Iran become stronger? There's no U.S. president that's going to do that as long as Iran is saying, I'm not making the bomb. So what Iran is doing, Iran is showing concession after concession and taking a harsh step in retaliation. So it's always on the defense, never took the initiative to attack and respond to the position that was taken by President Trump in 2018. So it went gradually, telling the West, I am going to escalate if you continue. And the West really doesn't care. So saying the cameras will roll again, or we keep all the films until we reach an agreement, is a showing good faith from Iran that the West is not going to take on board.
So let me stay with you, Elijah, pick up on what you've just said. So you're saying, because if we look at your statement, you're saying because Iran is saying it's not making the nuclear bomb, that there's no reason for the U.S. to really negotiate. Well, from the very beginning, Iran said, in the very beginning of all of this, it has said continuously that it is not after nuclear bomb or nuclear weapons, that actually the leader of the Islamic Revolution has said it is forbidden, as a matter of fact, for Iran to create the bomb. So with that being said, according to your premise, then how did we get here? Because if it's true that they're not going to do anything either way, then what was all of this about to begin with?
It is about Iran's influence in the Middle East. It is about Iran establishing allies in Palestine, in Lebanon, in Syria, in Iraq, in Yemen, where it is spoiling the U.S. and Israel plan. And President Obama tried, President Biden, President Trump tried also to include other dossiers rather than keeping only very strict on the nuclear dossier, because they want Iran to lift its hand on its allies in the Middle East and violate its own constitution to protect and support all the oppressed people in the world. So by this behavior, what the West calls the malign behavior of Iran, and they really are pointing out to that, they just don't consider the several tens of U.S. military bases surrounding Iran and established all over in the Middle East and Central Asia. So this is the main problem, is Iran nuclear peaceful program, but is above all it Iranian drones, Iranian precision missiles, and its support to its allies. This is what is the problem that is created today between Iran and the West.
Scott, what about that? Is this all about just putting pressure on Iran for Iran basically not to support its allies in the region, to change the overall perspective of the Islamic Republic? Is it all just an excuse?
Well, first of all, we have to understand that American policy towards Iran is not driven by logic, but by emotion. And at the root of it, of course, is the takeover of the U.S. embassy and holding Americans hostage. And I know that was a long time ago, but it resonates deeply with almost every American. I also think that we can't give short shrift to Israel's concerns. Israel's interpretation of Iran's nuclear program as any enrichment capability whatsoever constitutes a nuclear capability. And that's why Israel insists on zero enrichment. And now that Iran's taken it up to over 60% enrichment, they are literally months away from being able to enrich highly enriched uranium. And even though Iran has said that they won't do this, this is in violation of Islamic law. There's a fatwa against it. That doesn't make the Israelis feel any more comfortable. And the United States can't ignore Israeli concerns. But from the American perspective, too, I think we're looking at that there's a growing realization about the nexus between China, Russia, and Iran, that this troika of nations that are being increasingly isolated by the United States and Europe have found a way to come together, join with the rest of the world to create sort of a center of gravity that's independent of American and European influence. And this is very problematic. And so I do see the United States having an interest in trying to improve relations with Iran, to keep Iran connected to the West, to help slow down Iran's eastward transition. So it's a very complicated topic. I believe that nuclear issues are very much part of it, but Iran's regional presence is, as the gentleman said, Elijah said, the alleged malign activities are there. But I also think there's this new element, this new global reality based on BRICS and economics, et cetera, and the need by many in the United States to keep Iran from totally jumping ship, to find some mechanism to keep Iran engaged with the West. And the JCPOA would be that mechanism.
Well, Scott, just keeping in line with what you're saying, that because of this troika, this nexus that is taking place, the United States wants better relations with Iran. But the United States has continued to sanction Iran time after time again. So what does that mean? On the one hand, your analysis, you're saying that they do not want Iran to make this move to the east. But on the other hand, so not only did Trump leave the JCPOA, Biden has not returned to it. And during Biden's presidency, we have seen more sanctions against Iran. So what does that mean exactly?
Well, I think what it means is this is a policy of, hey, very much in transition, and we're in the early stages of this transition, and it's a policy that may never gain traction. All the things you mentioned took place prior to the Russian invasion of Ukraine. If you don't think that the Russian invasion of Ukraine and what has happened in the global scene has influenced every aspect of American policy, then I would say that you're probably misinformed about American policy. We're concerned about China. We're concerned about nexus between Russia and China. And now you have the added factor of Iran being driven into that company. So I believe that there are people right now in the Biden administration, in the national security establishment, that are concerned about this. This is a new development. But I do believe this is why you don't see the United States simply walk away from the JCPOA. This is why I believe that you see the United States still working behind the scenes to get the JCPOA up and running, because in their belief that would keep Iran engaged with the West in a potentially constructive manner and slow down and hopefully at some point in time stop the drift to the Russian-Chinese new center of gravity.
Elijah, I saw you shaking your head. Your thoughts on those comments?
I'm not sure the U.S. is really concerned and still interested in the JCPOA. I think the U.S. is concerned to make sure that this is not going to be the time when Iran is going to make a nuclear bomb while Biden is in power. So as long as Biden is there, he doesn't want to be remembered as the one who pushed Iran toward making nuclear weapons, because simply the U.S. doesn't believe in fatwa or in what the Grand Ayatollah Imam Khamenei said about is forbidden. They think, well, Iran has reached 60%. It means we are several months away from the 90%.
Elijah, do you really believe that the United States believe that?
Oh, yeah. The United States believe that Iran can go toward the nuclear weapon, and it is just enough for the Grand Ayatollah Khamenei to say, generally speaking, all fatwas can be revoked, then we will see a completely different behavior from the United States saying, well, now the nuclear weapon is on the Iranian table, and then we have to behave differently. But as long as the U.S. saying, well, we listen to what the Iranians are saying, we control them through the IAEA, we make sure that they're not going beyond the 60%, they all jump when they saw only residue of 84, not an enrichment to 84, 83.7%.
Okay.
So I think the objective is to make sure that this is not going to be a nuclear military weapon in Iran during the Biden administration. This is the only Biden's concern today.
Okay, and let me just turn to Scott, because I only have a couple of minutes left. Sorry, Elijah. Scott, you mentioned that this the U.S. and trying to get closer to Iran. But on the other hand, we talked about the Israeli factor and how Israel is very concerned about Iran and attaining a nuclear bomb, of course, that we've been hearing out of Tel Aviv for a long time right now. But at the other hand, we know that the Israelis actually possess nuclear weapons. So how does all of this fit in? On the one hand, we have the IAEA here talking about Iran and making sure that they abide by their agreements that they've gone beyond. On the other hand, you're talking about the U.S. wanting to get close to Iran, of course, but under the control, or at least they're following the Israeli line. So at the end of the day, what does it all mean?
Well, it means that nuclear nonproliferation policy is in a flux. I mean, the inherent contradictions where Iran is a signatory to the nonproliferation treaty and has been abiding by all of its obligations under the nonproliferation treaty. The United States is seeking to impose obligations beyond the nonproliferation treaty on Iran while receiving pressure from Israel, who hasn't signed the nonproliferation treaty, won't sign the nonproliferation treaty, and has pursued an independent nuclear weapons program. There's just absolute illogic in this. So it's very difficult to find some sort of path toward consistency, which is why everything we're talking about today is so frustrating, because it's not black and white. It's very, you know, numerous shades of gray. But again, now we come back to the original thing. That's why I think the discussion between Grossi and the Iranians is important, because it does provide, you know, some foundation of stability upon which hopefully, you know, a logical progression towards a resolution of this problem can be reached.
Okay.
But it's very complicated.
All right. And on that note, I'd like to thank both of you for being with me on Spotlight. Out of Brussels, Elijah Magnier, journalist and political analyst out of Bethlehem, New York. Scott Ritter, former UN weapons inspector. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi, signing out for myself and all the crew right here in Tehran.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in southern Africa via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sador Bat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio Call of Islam page. Well, welcome to another episode of the program Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs. I am Atan, the host of this program. With me in the studio, we have a very special guest speaker from the Islamic House of Qom, Sheikh Karimi. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh. Welcome to the show.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah, and thank you for having me.
Today we want to talk about the personality of Aaron, brother of Moses, as pictured in the Holy Quran. Some people might ask that there must be some contrast in picturing Aaron, the brother of Moses, in Surah Taha of the Holy Quran. We can say in one picture we have a believing person who believed in Moses and only Allah, and in the other picture we have a person who was somehow an accomplice in calf worshipping of the Banu Israel instead of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. We know that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala gave Moses 40 days in order to go somewhere to worship Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, to find a spiritual perfection. And when he was back, he find that summary has made a calf of gold and the people of Banu Israel started worshipping it. So how do you answer this question, Sheikh?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. According to verses of the Quran, no one can blame Aaron or Prophet Harun alayhi salam. And the Quran is very clear and explicit in this regard, and there is no contradiction. There is only one misunderstanding of one of the verses that we need to talk about. Now, according to, some verses of the Quran, Harun tried his best to, fight against Samaria and those people of Banu Israel who began worshipping the calf. In chapter Al-A'raf, verse 150, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم ولما رجع موسى إلى قومه غضبان آسفا. So we know that Moses was in Mount Sinai for 40 days. So when he returned to his people, he was wrathful in violent grief. And he said, evil is that you have done after me. Evil is that you have done after me. Did you turn away from the bidding of your Lord? And he threw down the tablets and seized his brother by the head. Now, some people, as I mentioned, they try to refer to this part of the verse that أَخَذَ بِرَأْسَ أَخِيهِ يَجُرُّهُ إِلَيْهِ. Moses, seized his brother by the head, dragging him toward him. He said, Harun alayhi